The opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect those of the management of KUCI or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on the show, go to kuci.org. You are listening to 88.9 FM in Irvine. Greetings, everybody. This is Katrina Kirkaby, and I'm here with Tina Spindler, and we are your Master Garden hosts today of In the Garden with UC Master Gardeners. Welcome, Tina.
Hey, Katrina. How are you? Happy almost spring.
I know. How exciting, isn't it?
Yeah, boy. I hope you've been napping and catching up on your rest, because we got to be in the garden full time in March, right?
Well, March is a busy month. I am so excited.
Yeah. We can garden, of course, all year here in Southern California, but we do have two seasons. We have the cool season, which we've are about to come out of, and the warm season, and that transitional time is right now in March, where we're going to start transitioning from cool to warm. So that means lots to do in the garden.
Lots to do in the garden, and everything is starting to grow.
Yeah, everything is growing like crazy. You'll be seeing your trees leafing out, or if they're fruiting or flowering trees, they're probably flowering, and it's just, oh gosh, it's such a beautiful, exciting time in the garden.
There's so much to do and so much fun stuff, and I love this time of year because the hope of greenness and flowers and plants and, oh,
yeah,
exciting.
It's a new beginning. I mean, that's the amazing thing about gardening is, you know, even if you had little failures or frustrations or you got too busy over the holidays to get out there, it is a place where you can start new, and especially in March when it's a beginning of a brand new season. There's just all mistakes are erased, all failures, all bad decisions, everything is
starting anew.
Starting anew, exactly. So where should we begin?
Oh my gosh, there's so many. Where should we begin? How about vegetables? I love vegetables.
Let's talk about vegetables. Oh yeah, that'll make me hungry. So my veggie garden, cool season veggie garden, is still going strong, so that's pretty exciting. Still have lots of spinach and lettuce. Peas are actually just now taking off because I got them in late. But what we need to realize is that those cool season vegetables will still do well for a couple of months, but come June, when the weather starts turning warm-ish, we're going to need to really want to have our warm season vegetables planted already. So March is when you can first start planting them, because that's the end of our potential frost season. Now, we were getting frost. I know the last time I saw frost was probably early February, because we had such a warm February, you know. Mm-hmm. Gosh, those couple of weeks in the 80s and so. We haven't seen frost for a while, but you never know. That first week of March, I'll tell you what, if I ever plant tomatoes like the end of February, we always get a frost the first week of March. So if you do plant warm season plants like tomatoes or peppers at the first of March, watch the temperature.
Yes,
at night.
Be very careful. You got to take care of your babies.
Yeah. And if we are going to get a frost, doesn't mean that you'll lose your tomatoes or get damage if you take a few precautions. So let's talk a little bit about frost precautions. If you plant tomatoes, then just be sure that you either have stakes near them or tomato cages over them or a trellis or something, because if you know there's going to be frost, take an old sheet and go outside and drape those plants with an old sheet to keep the frost from, you know, getting those tender new plants. So that's super easy to do. And then the next morning when you wake up, you go out and you take it off. You don't want to have those plants be covered up during the day. When the sun comes out, it'll turn into an oven under
cook your babies
that cover.
Yeah.
So just look at the weather. And once it turns dark, you know, take an old sheet out there, cover them up if you think there's going to be frost, and then uncover them the next morning.
Or you can wait the first couple weeks and make sure your soil's great, you've weeded your garden, and spend the first couple weeks prepping the soil.
Exactly. So if you don't have your plants yet, you can, as Katrina said, just spend that time getting everything ready. Because the worst thing that I do, and I'm always so tempted to do this, is I go to the nursery first, or to one of the great plant shows, like at Cal State Fullerton or the Fullerton Arboretum or Tomato Mania, you know, travels to different nurseries. And I buy all these plants and I'm so excited, but guess what? I don't have anywhere to plant them because I have not prepared a bed yet, or I still have lettuce in the bed where the tomatoes need to go. So, Katrina, you're right. You absolutely should prepare first and then buy.
That's exactly why I know about this, Tina. I've done it so many times. It's so hard because you go and you just want to look, but then you buy.
So and how many tomato plants have we killed because we haven't ended up getting them planted?
It's sad.
Yeah,
it's
very sad. There should be a, you know, tomato-aholics club or something to support us not doing those bad habits. The main moral of the story is you want to start thinking about switching from your cool season stuff to your warm season stuff. So as you see that lettuce bolting, which, believe it or not, I had lettuce bolting in February already because we got that hot spell. So when that happens, pull it out, prepare your soil, and be all ready to go and buy those yummy, scrumptious tomatoes that you want to have.
Yeah. Fullerton Arboretum is going to be having a tomato sale.
They do every year, and it's awesome.
Their tomato sale is fantastic. It is incredible. I believe this year it's going to be March 19th and 20th.
Perfect timing.
And yeah. Saturday and Sunday, and I suggest go early. They have, it's like a candy store for tomato lovers.
Yeah.
There's just so many different kinds to choose from. They have it up on their website, and you can go and actually read about it because there's hundreds of tomato plants to choose from. And you want big ones or small ones or, you know, red ones or white ones or black ones or whatever. It's a great place to go look.
Yeah, that's a good thing to talk about is how to choose tomatoes. Of course, any homegrown tomato is going to beat anything you buy in the store, hands down. But a couple things that our listeners should know about tomatoes, and we have a tomato podcast that we have on our website. So if you're interested in learning more, you can go to UCCE.com and look for our tomato show that we did in the past. But just briefly, tomatoes have two basic types. They're called determinate and indeterminate. The determinate ones grow to a certain size, then they flower and they fruit kind of all at once. I mean, basically you'll harvest over, you know, several weeks, but they don't go the whole season long. And the Italian plum tomatoes that are used for sauce are one of the prime examples of a determinate type of tomato. You want a determinate type of tomato if you're going to make sauce, because you don't want to have just a couple tomatoes a week. You want to get a whole big batch of tomatoes so that you can make your sauce. But the indeterminate tomatoes are the ones that grow and continue to produce the whole season long. And those in particular will get quite tall, or can get quite tall, because they just keep growing and growing and growing. So you want to make sure you have tall tomato cages or tall trellises or tall stakes that you can tie those tomatoes to. And they can be either heirloom or hybrids. And if you haven't grown tomatoes, an heirloom tomato is one that has usually been grown for many years. It's usually prized for its flavor, but sometimes they are not as disease resistant as the modern hybrids, which have been bred with, you know, different parents to have traits that resist disease, have a good growing habit, and so on and so forth, but sometimes always aren't as flavorful as the heirlooms. So the best thing to do, as Katrina said, is to do a little bit of research. Just read about tomatoes, look at the seed catalogs online. They'll give you descriptions of every single variety of tomato, and the ones that sound attractive to you, you know, give them a try.
Give them a try.
There's also some All-American selections that have been tried and true for many years. And also, if you've had good luck, what I always do is I always plant the couple of tomatoes that I have good luck with every year. I always plant Celebrity. I always plant Early Girl. They're hybrids. They're disease resistant. And I plant those every year because I know I'm going to get tomatoes if I plant those two plants.
Exactly.
And yeah. Do you have a favorite, Katrina, that you plant every year?
Oh, Sun Gold. It's a little yellow cherry tomato, which is absolutely yummy, and I just love that thing. It's a must. But I also want to let our audience know is sometimes people forget what indeterminate and determinate mean, and I tend to like indeterminate, which means they go for an indeterminate amount of time.
Absolutely.
And that way I get a little bit all the time. And since I don't need a huge crop at any one time, and that's what I like. Also, I look for, if I'm only going to grow a few, I really like what Tina said about Celebrity or a couple of the others. And if you can't remember that, they usually have a bunch of numbers behind letters or numbers or letters behind the name of the tomato. And the more you have, the more disease resistant it seems to be. So I always try to get at least one or two with a lot like that, that I know it's going to be prolific, and then I go exploring from there.
Right. And the letters that Katrina's referring to are letters like V for verticillium wilt. And so when there's a V after the name of the tomato, it means it's resistant to that disease. So that's what you want to look for, is if there are several different letters, each of those letters stands for the disease that that plant is resistant to. So like she said, if you see a tag that has a lot of letters on it, that means it's resistant to a lot of different diseases, which is good. Tomatoes are notorious for being susceptible, especially to fungal diseases. And then also they're susceptible to root knot nematode, which is a little microscopic worm that lives in the soil that causes the roots to get these knots on, which causes the plant not to do very well. So there's a lot of joy in tomatoes because you love that beautiful homegrown fruit, but there's a few, you know, challenges with them too. And so one of the ways that you can prevent some of these challenges is, as Katrina said, buy the disease-resistant varieties. Those would be hybrids that have been bred to be disease-resistant. But like I said, I also choose a couple of heirlooms or new varieties that I've never tried before, just for fun.
For fun.
Because
depends on how much room you have.
Yeah, because you never know. You may find a new favorite that you're going to plant every year.
Sun Gold.
Yeah, Sun Gold is foolproof every year.
It's a wonderful little cherry tomato. And you also want to think about the size of the tomato you're going to have. If you're living in have a small space, you can't have one of these 10-foot tall tomato plants. You know, find something that will fit in a container that works for where you live.
Right, exactly. And always with container-grown tomatoes, remember, the bigger the container, the better. So don't try to grow a tomato in a one-gallon pot. You won't be very successful, and your plant won't be very happy. So minimum, you know, 5-gallon pot, but I actually like to do pots that are about 14 to 18 inches wide if I'm going to grow them in a pot. They seem to do a lot better that way. And then if you do have limited space, consider trellising them rather than having the big round tomato cages. This is my favorite way to grow tomatoes because I have only 3 raised beds that I grow edibles in. So I just put a trellis made out of those posts that you tie trees to, mm-hmm. you know, those big stakes. And then I get concrete reinforcing wire, and I just use zip ties to hook the concrete reinforcing wire to the stakes, and I just let it be a trellis along one edge of my beds, and then I grow the tomatoes up against that trellis. So rather than letting them kind of sprawl in a big old round cage, I tie the plant to that trellis, and I make it kind of grow horizontal, kind of like a spallion, a fruit tree.
And it's beautiful. You know, and I have a lot of space, and I do the same thing. And so if you have a smaller space or a larger space, what Tina was just talking about is a great way to get, to, you know, it gets a lot of sun, more areas exposed to the sun.
Easier to pick, too.
It's easier to pick. It's easy to just, you know, tie those little branches up with some tape. And I love doing it that way. I've been doing that for a long time now, and it is my favorite way. I do have some tomato cages, but by far I love what you're talking about. And what Tina's talking about, too, is that you could put it up almost against a wall.
Yeah.
And then you could plant other things in front of it, which gives you, if you have more limited space, it gives you a lot more bang for your buck.
Exactly. Just make sure you put your trellis in the part of your bed so that it's not going to be shading any plants behind it. So watch the path of the sun before you choose where to put that trellis, because you don't want to plant a bunch of other plants, you know, like your peppers, behind that trellis and have them be in shade all the time from the tomato plant. So that's just a good thing to remember before you get that thing set up.
Tina, aren't you going to be doing a show in a couple weeks about vegetables?
I am. We are going to have a great guest in March, Kay Havens, who's been on the show with us before. She's another master gardener who is one of our very favorite people because she's so knowledgeable. And she is going to be talking about the hot season. So we're not going to take any more time talking about tomatoes, because she's really going to get into tomatoes and peppers and the details of other hot season vegetables. But suffice it to say, because we are in early March, we want to just give you a heads up about what you should be planting,
looking for this month, thinking about, and getting ready for.
But later this month, listen for our show with Kay Havens, and she will get into a lot more details about tomatoes, peppers, cucumbers, other squashes, all of those hot season vegetables.
So I think we're making a case for getting your ground prepared.
Absolutely.
Because once you hear Kay speak, you're going to want to go shopping for vegetables right away.
Absolutely.
And if your ground's prepared, you can go shopping for vegetables and put them in the ground right away.
And that's the fun part, right? So should we talk for a minute about the work part, the getting your soil ready?
Let's talk about the work part.
Okay. So to get your soil ready, and we've had whole shows on soil too, but we'll briefly talk about it. You want to identify your space. It needs to be a space, if you're going to grow vegetables, that's in full sun, which means 6 hours of full sun a day, at least 6 to 8 hours. And you want to get a shovel. No two ways about it. Got to get out and do some work, and then grab a really strong person you can bribe to do the hard work for you. Your husband, promise him a good meal, or, you know.
And if you're a husband listening to the show, your wife will be so appreciative. Or if you're a boyfriend listening to the show, your girlfriend will be really appreciative.
That's right.
I'm really thankful to my husband that he does this for me.
Right. Or if you're a teenage son, you can probably talk your mom into, you know, doing something nice for you. So anyway, find someone with a strong back, and what you want to do is get a shovel. Or if you're looking to burn a few calories yourself, get a shovel. You want to dig down about 8 inches, turn that soil over, then dump bags of soil amendment on top of it. You can go to any big box retail store or nursery, and you want to get something that is usually labeled compost. Sometimes it's called garden soil, but it's not really garden soil. It's really compost. And you want to dump about, you know, 3 to even 6 inches of that compost on top of your soil. And while you're at it, you want to add some organic fertilizer while you're mixing this soil together, according to whatever fertilizer you buy, the directions, because every fertilizer is different in its strength, and so you really need to read those directions. Sprinkle that fertilizer the correct amount over the soil and the compost that you sprinkled on. And if this were TV, you could see me sprinkling.
I'm watching you sprinkle.
I don't know why I have to sprinkle when I talk about it, but my hand is sprinkling. And then you want to get your cultivator, your hand cultivator, which is that long-handled tool that has 4 curved tines at the end of it. And you want to just chop that soil up. So you want to chop all those dirt clods up. You want to turn that soil, get it all finely chopped up so that it's nice and ready for that new tomato plant or pepper or green bean seeds or whatever you're planting.
And this could be so much fun. You know, just go play in the dirt. It's like a foundation of the house. If you don't have a good foundation, you're not going to have a strong house. So you need to have good soil so you can have strong, healthy plants.
You absolutely do. And don't bite off more than you can chew. You know, every year as I get older, there's less and less that I want to dig, right? So now I don't even try. My raised beds are pretty big, so they're like 5 feet by 10 feet long. And I don't even try to turn the whole thing at once. You know, I give myself half of the bed. If I can get half a bed, the soil prepped in half of that bed one morning, you know, then that's enough for that day. I can do the second half of the bed another day. So don't bite off more than you can chew, because the turning of the soil and preparing the soil is the hard work. So,
and remember, it's supposed to be fun.
Yeah, pace yourself.
Pace yourself and have fun.
Yeah, exactly. So, I think that's enough for veggie gardens, because we're going to talk about more about hot veggies later in the month.
You know what? Why don't we tell them, just without telling them what to do, about some vegetables that they could be planting so they could think about it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I kind of ran off a list, but let's talk about it a little bit more. When we say the squashes, we mean the cucumbers. We mean pumpkins, any of the zucchini, you know, type of squashes, the spaghetti squash, all of those members of that family. Those are all hot season. You can plant those from seed or from six packs that you buy at one of these, you know, great plant shows that happen in the springtime. So many different kinds of green beans. Oh my gosh.
Oh my gosh.
I started growing the French filet beans. I like those so much
really?
Better. Oh, I love them because they're thin.
Yeah, you pick them. I like them too.
Yeah, you pick them when they're thin and they don't have the big seeds.
And they're,
you know,
softer and more tender.
Yeah. So, but you know, the old fashioned Kentucky blue, you know, those are great too if you like those green beans. Lima beans, you know, there's all Italian beans, those flat Italian beans.
Kale.
Yeah. You can still do kale. We do kale in the winter, but kale seems to survive the summer better than lettuce.
I can grow kale most year long.
Exactly.
Maybe there's hardier types of kale.
It doesn't seem to bolt like the lettuces do. So when your lettuce starts bolting, you know, you can still try some kale, and it might last you through the summer. Unless you live in a super hot part of Orange County, then maybe you won't have success with it. But it's hot where you are, so.
It's hot, and I grow kale all year long.
Yeah.
There's not a time I don't have kale growing.
I love kale. It's my new favorite vegetable the last couple years.
Tina, try this one. I plant like six different kinds of kale.
Oh, wow.
And it's so, you know, people think there's certain kind of kale, but I have six different kind going, and I mix them all together, and it changes the color and the taste. And
so good for you. Oh, my gosh.
I'm a kale fan.
Yeah, so good for you.
And peppers, red peppers and yellow peppers and
green
peppers.
All the different peppers, hot peppers, sweet peppers. Kay's going to talk about peppers. She's going to, I know she'll tell us all about the hotness scale, which just... That's so crazy to talk about. That'll
be fun. 2 weeks from today, we're going to be playing that. So.
Good. That'll be really fun. And then if you have space, the melons, watermelon, cantaloupe, all of the different melons that you can never find in the store. Oh, they're, if you have space, so fun to try all different kinds of melons. So, yeah, there's just so many hot season vegetables, and we'll be talking all about it in 2 weeks.
An hour about hot season vegetables.
So get ready. So
get ready.
Yeah. But in the meantime, we want to talk about the other stuff you should be doing in March in your garden, right? So what should we talk about next, do you think?
You know, March, we're going to start getting pests in the garden.
Yeah, that's
a good
true.
Time. We better start taking care of it. Well, let's talk about pests, why they're waiting to plant these plants after they dug up the yard.
Right.
They can start looking for these pests.
Absolutely, because...
And what do we do about them?
Well, we practice IPM, of course.
And what does IPM mean, Tina?
Integrated Pest Management.
And what does that mean?
Well, in case everyone's eyes are now glazing over, it really is super simple. It just means use the least toxic method of controlling plants that you possibly can. And so let's talk quickly about what those are. First of all, you want to plant the right plant in the right season, in the right place, with the right spacing. And that it's because if you practice good plant culture, which means the way you grow the plants, you're going to have less problems. But if you're like me and you decide you have to have one more tomato plant, so you're going to squeeze that tomato plant in, those tomatoes are not going to be as healthy, and they're going to attract more pests. So pay attention to the spacing. Don't be a hog like I am and try to squeeze in more plants than you should, because you need good air circulation and other good practices like good soil preparation to have strong plants, because strong plants aren't as susceptible as weak plants are to pests. But just given the season, because it's spring and the weather's starting to warm up, you're going to get pests, even if you have good practices.
It's like you get weeds, you're going to have pests.
Right. So the next thing you want to do is you want to think about, okay, what can I do to prevent those pests or get rid of them easily and quickly? Well, another thing that you can think about is physical barriers. So, well, what does that mean? Well, some of us have heard about using copper tape to make snails not crawl into a pot or on the trunk of a tree. So that's a physical barrier. You can also set up I use little pieces of 2x4 and a brick, and I lean that piece of wood up against the brick, and it's not actually a barrier, but the snails will come congregate in that shady spot, and then you can just pick them off and throw them away. And then, you know, if you've done good cultural practices and you've used some physical barriers, you can use the hand method or the water method of getting rid of your pests. And one of the best things is to take that brass nozzle on your hose, turn it to a really strong jet of water, and if you see aphids, squirt those guys goodbye. Same thing with whitefly. Squirt them goodbye. And if you do that several days a week, when you see an infestation, before it gets too heavy, you'll usually be able to eradicate it and keep it under control. And then also you can hand pick, you know, snails and other insects off. And then finally, as a last resort, you can use a pesticide, but we always advise using the least toxic pesticide possible. So before you bring out any heavy chemicals, try using a mild insecticidal soap or the organic iron-based snail baits. Those are less harmful to, you know, people and the environment and pests. So we want to use the least toxic pesticide possible, because if we use some of those broad-spectrum chemical pesticides, we're not only going to kill the insects that we don't like, aphids, etc., that are damaging our plants, but we're going to kill bees and perhaps some other beneficial organisms like ladybugs, etc., that we don't want to kill. So
exactly.
So that's what IPM is. Use the least toxic thing you can to kill or prevent the pests.
And right now, this is a really good time to do the prevention part. If you do a lot of prevention right now, you won't have the problems down the line. So we're talking about this right now because it's going to save you a lot of time and energy, and your garden will be better in balance. And it's just be mindful as you're waiting for those tomato plants to plant in mid-March. After you hear about Tina and Kay's show, you could be out there looking for pests right now.
Yeah, and it's especially true for snails, because I don't know about your yard, Katrina, but I have, you know, tons of the deciduous trees in my yard. So even though we try to keep the leaf litter cleaned up, you know, it still congregates in corners and under shrubs and stuff. Well, guess where the snails are going to go hang out and breed? So I really do try to make an effort this time of year to clean up the remaining bit of leaf litter and any fallen twigs and so on and so forth that would give insects or snails a place to breed. Because if I get rid of that, I'm a little bit ahead of the game. And then I will put out some snail bait this month especially, because if you do it this month, you'll have so many less snails in April and May. And if you don't do anything this month, because you're not maybe seeing a lot of them yet because they're in their egg stage, you know, they're just beginning to breed, you'll have so many in April and May. So put snail bait out this month and you'll have way less.
Yeah. Well, Tina, I need to take a moment and tell everybody that the opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect those of the management of KUCI or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this show, go to kuci.org. And you are also listening to 88.9 FM in Irvine. Ah, Tina, where should we go from here?
Could we talk about flowers? One of my favorite things.
Yes, let's talk about flowers. Yeah. It's that time. It's ready. We're ready.
Well, what's cool is if our listeners were following our suggestions about cool season flower gardens, they would have planted a ton of cool season stuff last October, November. And I bet if they did, their gardens are looking pretty nice right now in March. Mm-hmm. So if you had the cool season flowers like snapdragon, stock, pansies, Iceland poppies, those cool season blooming things that we planted in the fall, they're probably looking great right now.
Yeah, and if they lasted through this the last couple weeks, you know.
The little heat wave.
They made it through the heat wave.
So if your garden is full and blooming right now, don't do anything. But remember that just like with your vegetable garden, March is the time to switch out your flower garden to warm season plants too. Now, I often don't have a lot of room because I do have a lot of cool season stuff blooming. And the other thing, as anybody who listens regularly knows, I plant a lot of bulbs. And so I've got a ton of bulbs blooming, usually still in early March. But what I do is I get ready to have those warm season flowers later on. When the cool season ones start pooping out the end of May and June, I want to have stuff that I can plop right in the ground. So I like to plant some stuff from seed because I like tall flowers that I can pick. And so I go and get the seed packets that have the taller varieties of zinnias. And if you've never planted the zinnias that get 3 to 4 feet tall, oh, you got to try it.
Gotcha.
Because they are
stunning.
Stunning in the garden, and they have nice long, you know, 10, 12-inch stems, so you can pick them and bring them in the house. And they come in the most awesome colors, you know, bright pinks and purples and oranges and yellows. And so I love to plant the long, tall-stemmed zinnias in six-packs. And then I just let the seedlings grow, you know, until the end of April or so, sometime in May. And then they'll be the right size to put out in the garden when I'm pulling out the snapdragons because they're full of rust or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then I can pop those zinnias in the ground. And I also do the other favorite that I have are the cosmos.
Yes.
Because the cosmos you can get in the nurseries are great, but they often don't have the tall varieties, which I prefer. And they also often only come in mixed colors. And in my yard, I like to have swaths of color. I don't like it to be a pink one, a white one, you know, a purple one. I like it to be this section that's all pink or this section that's all white, because I just think you can design a pretty garden easier with single colors. So that's my suggestion, is to start some from seed.
And you know what else is nice about starting from seed is that the choices you have.
Oh
my gosh, a packet of seed is so inexpensive, and it's wonderful getting them from the stores, but you're really limited on what you get. And when you look through the seed catalogs, there's so much to choose from. And then people will come over to your house and they'll go, well, where'd you get that? And that's a unique plant. Well, it's maybe not that unique. It's just you can't find it at the local store.
No, the nurseries have limited space, right?
Right.
And most people see something beautiful and colorful and they buy that. And so the nurseries and the growers also specialize in shorter plants that will bloom in the six-pack or the 4-inch pot. And so that's why you see so many short varieties, is because they bloom while they're in the nursery pack, and that makes them easier to sell. So you have to, if you want these tall varieties, often plant them yourself from seed. But I love to do it. I think it's really rewarding.
And you know what else is nice about it? Throwing another benefit of doing that is that you get height in your garden. So you could have something tall and then something a little bit shorter and then something smaller in front of that. So you make it so much more three-dimensional.
Absolutely. And I also plant some short varieties too, you know, mm-hmm. to balance out the bed. But I usually focus on tall ones for me because it's just hard to find those. You know, you can find the shorter varieties in the nursery. But yeah, so if you don't have room right now, go ahead and plant from seed. But if you do have room and you want to go ahead and just purchase them from, you know, the nursery or the big box retailers, you know, go for it. Vinca, lobelia, all the different kinds of marigolds, the impatiens, you know, all of those are the plants that are going to last you throughout the summer and do well in our warmer temperatures as that happens.
And you know what also I think people should think about is how close people are going to be to their plant. as far as distance. I know that when you come in my driveway, you have to. I plant bigger plants so you could see them from the distance. And some people have smaller yards where it doesn't take as much to make a statement. So also think about where you're planting the plant to think about the size and the color. What color will pop at the distance you're looking at?
That's a great comment. You know, in my garden that I actually follow that philosophy when I designed it and as I plant every year. And what I do is I save the bright colors, the reds, the oranges, and the yellow for the far back of my garden. Mm. And I keep the softer colors towards the front of the garden, because when you are in the house and looking outside, in order for your eyes to go all the way to the back of the garden, you need something that attracts your eyes back there. And those bright colors do that. So, and one thing, though, I'll also point out that is a good design trick is you don't, at least I don't like to have all of the different colors mixed all together, that it is more pleasing to the eye to have these different swaths of color that belong together. But one of the ways that you can transition from, you know, a pink garden to a red or an orange garden is I use a lot of white. And as you know, Katrina, I use a lot of Shasta daisies in my garden. And what happens is you keep plopping those in, and so that becomes the thing that makes your garden come together, is you see these spots of white, you know, every so mm-hmm. often throughout the garden. And that way it is easier for you to transition from, you know, one color to another color if you want to do that in your garden.
Good point. And those Shasta daisies are beautiful. Those are, talk about being able to pick some of those. Oh, my goodness.
Well, and you can't kill them. And the bunnies don't eat them because, you know, I get a lot of rabbits in my yard. So I love them. They bloom probably from late April until September-ish. And then they're just kind of a low green plant. They're mm-hmm. evergreen. So they never really look ugly, but they don't bloom, you know, the whole year.
But they're a nice green plant in your yard for yeah. all year long.
They are. And like I said, you can't kill them. They're just, I mean, I planted the original ones in my yard 10, 11 years ago, and they also spread. So the little clumps that I planted have grown and grown. And one thing that's nice about it is I don't have to dig up a lot of my yard and replant it. I just kind of let the Shasta daisies fill in, and then I just do little pockets here and there. So it's not a huge big deal to change out the color, you know, seasonally.
Now, whenever we do a show, you guys listen to what Tina does, because her yard is always so beautiful.
Oh, you're so...
Oh, it's so true.
So nice. This,
it is. It's so true. And you do things that are wise, you know, to think about, well, what can I do? Because it would be, if she wasn't smart about it, she'd be spending her whole life in her garden, because it's a good-sized garden. It's big.
It is, yeah. And, you know, you especially the older you get, you have to garden smarter, not harder, right? So let's talk about doing that. And one of the ways you can garden smarter is to plant blooming perennials, because the Shasta daisies, for instance, are a perennial. They last more than 1 year. So if you plant perennials, blooming perennials, are what I particularly like, you end up having this color that repeats itself for more than 1 year, and you don't have to go out and dig up the soil. You do it once, you prepare the soil well, and then you have these perennial flowers that are blooming for more than 1 year. And a couple of my favorites are Achillea, also known as yarrow. I also like the Rudbeckias. They're not very long-lived perennials. They'll last maybe just a couple of years. But the cool thing about the Rudbeckias is they'll self-sow. So I do love that about them, that they do self-sow. And they give you, again, great cutting flowers, because the Rudbeckias are basically those, well, I think some people call them black-eyed Susans. Mm-hmm. This is another common name for mm-hmm. them. And so when you pick those black-eyed Susans and the Shasta daisies and maybe a couple of roses, you've got just the most awesome bouquet to bring inside your house.
Beautiful.
Yes.
Beautiful.
So
easy to grow, too.
Easy to
grow.
They're
not temperamental.
So go to the nursery, take a look at the... It's also a great time to choose perennials, because many of them bloom in the spring. And so go to the nursery, take a look at the perennials that are blooming, find some that are the right size and color for the look that you want, and remember to dig a really nice hole for them because they're going to live in that hole for hopefully a few years.
You know what? One of the hard things with me is to look at the size they're going to get.
Yeah. They're so nice and tidy when they're in the nursery, aren't they?
Yeah. But really read that little sticker that they put in there. Really read it because it might be 10 foot tall.
So, yeah, definitely.
And I have tried to grow plants that have been too big for the area I put them in. And I have spent so much time trying to keep them small. And they're not happy small, and I'm miserable because I just have to spend my summer pruning them.
Right, and one of the ones Katrina's probably fought with are some of the salvias. I love salvias, but you can have salvias that only grow 10 inches tall, and then there are salvias that grow taller than me. You know, the Salvia leucantha, the Mexican sage. I mean, that thing grows, you know, 6 feet tall when it's blooming.
I had these three beautiful salvias in my front flower bed, and they were beautiful, but they took over my flower. And I really couldn't have much of anything else. And every week I was out there cutting them.
Right.
And finally, it was hard to get rid of them because they were big and beautiful, but it cut down so much on the amount of time I had to garden. I'm so glad they're gone.
Well, I hear you. I actually transplanted, and I don't even remember the name of it now. It wasn't Salvia leucantha. It was a different one, but it got so big in my flower bed. It was the same thing. It was like 6 feet tall and 6 feet wide. It had taken over an entire flower bed. So I pruned it down one winter to just 18 inches tall and dug it up and transplanted it on my slope. And fortunately, it took, and
It's
happy there. And I love
it. And you're happy it's there.
And I love that there's 6 feet of salvia up on the slope, which, you know, there's not a lot that wants to grow on that slope. So Katrina's absolutely right. When you go to the nursery and you look at all those really cool perennials, be sure you read the tag and make sure it's going to fit in the space that you want it to fit in.
And don't try to push it.
Yeah.
You know, it just doesn't work. Trust us.
We do it, and we've paid the price, so.
And we do it over again,
yeah.
You know.
Oh. Slow learners. And then the last thing I want to talk about while we're talking about blooming things is bulbs, because, of course, everybody knows that's one of my favorite things. If you want to plant some bulbs that will bloom in the summertime, hopefully, if you planted your fall bulbs, you're enjoying an amazing bloom right now, and you have tons of gorgeous flowers to bring in the house. But those are going to be over soon if they aren't over already. And so now you can plant some great summer bulbs like gladiola, or the dahlias are my favorite. They're actually a tuber, not technically a bulb. But and the glads are technically a corm, not a true bulb like a daffodil. But the gladiola and the dahlias make wonderful, colorful flowers over the summer, and they're just so easy to grow.
Easy to plant, and they're gorgeous.
Yeah. Look for those in the nursery as well. They always come with little instructions on the packages, so we won't get into that. But they will come back every year, so put them in a place. You know, if you want them to come back every year, put them in a place that you know you're not going to dig them up. And they multiply, which is another kind of added benefit. And then every few years you should dig them up because they'll get too dense. But
What a problem to have.
Yeah,
too many flowers.
I know. So, yeah, do that. There's also tuberous begonias, tigridias. Those are a couple of others that you can plant this time of year. And have some beautiful, beautiful blooms for great bouquets.
Oh, I'm getting so excited. I can't believe it.
Yeah. So what else? Oh, I guess one more flowering thing we should talk about, roses.
Yeah.
Because even though we are probably not going to be out of our drought this year because we didn't quite get the rain we thought we were going to get in January and February, so maybe we need to keep control of the size of our flower gardens because we may not have tons of water to use on them. But one of the things I discovered last summer throughout the drought, and I think you did too, Katrina, is that our roses actually did okay with a lot less water.
You know, Tina, I'm surprised that a lot of my plants did okay with a lot less water. I mean, some didn't, but I think we could a lot of times use less than what we really thought.
Yeah.
And roses in particular.
Roses in particular, because remember, whereas some of the annuals may have shallow roots, the flowering annuals have kind of shallow roots, our roses have pretty deep roots. Mm-hmm. So as long as you can water them deeply, periodically, they're kind of okay to dry out in between waterings. Mine did just fine.
Oh, yours are stunning.
Yeah. So anyway, this time of year, though, what you want to watch for on your roses is hopefully you pruned them in January, as we advised, to force them to go dormant, since roses don't naturally go dormant in California. And also you sprayed them with some fungal sprays or horticultural oil to prevent disease and insects. And that you would have done in January. So by now, in March, you should see those plants leafing out. And they probably started leafing out in February when we had that warm heat spell. Once they start leafing out, that's when you want to start feeding them. So if you didn't give them their first feeding in February when they started leafing out, you for sure want to give them some food, some fertilizer in March, because that is what they're going to use to give you those great, big, gorgeous first flush bloom of roses, which is always so amazing in April or May. Just, I love that first bloom. It's always so, so pretty. And then just make sure that you feed them and watch for aphids. Usually the aphids want to attack those new leaves and the new buds. And when you see that happening, just spray it off with a strong jet of water and keep an eye on them for pests. And you should have gorgeous, gorgeous roses come April and May.
I'm sitting here smiling. I'm so excited.
Yeah.
the springtime.
At least I hope so, since my garden's going to be on a garden tour in April. So, speaking of that, there's so many garden tours. You can, you know, look in the newspaper, go online, Google garden tours in your area. The one that mine's going to be on this year is the Mary Lou Hurd garden tour. That's a pretty fun one. But so many organizations have them. You know, Sherman Gardens has a great garden tour. So do start looking in the paper towards the end of March. Most of the garden tours start in April and run through May. And they're just really fun.
Oh, and it's just fun to go to see what different people are doing in their homes and get ideas and what works for you and what doesn't work for you. And it's just beautiful. It's a nice way to spend a day.
It is. It is. You know, some of them cost money. Some of them don't. The Mary Lou Hurd one doesn't cost anything to go on. And they say it's real gardens by real people. And so you're basically going to people's houses and seeing how they garden in all different kinds of situations. You know, small gardens, big gardens, shady gardens, sunny gardens.
And it's amazing. It's really so amazing. We talk about gardening, but it just, when you go on one of these tours, it just, all the different types of gardens, like you're saying. I mean, some small, small spaces could have the most incredible gardens, and, you know, people have formal gardens and informal gardens and country more gardens and succulents and cactus and drought tolerant. And, you know, if you're thinking about doing something with your garden, it's a nice thing to do.
Oh, you get so many ideas. And
the Native Plant Society is having a garden tour.
Are they?
They are having a garden tour.
Do you know
this year.
What month that one's in?
No, but
we'll find out for another show. Yeah. Just Google garden tours, and you'll come up with all sorts of ones. And speaking of the Native Plant Society and native plants, I do want to let folks know that March is not too late if they do want to transition to a more drought-tolerant garden. March is still a good month to plant those natives and other drought-tolerant plants. March would probably be my last favorite month to do it. You could still do it in April, but the goal, remember, is you want to get those plants settled in well before we get into the heat of summer. So by planting them in March, they still have March, April, and May, maybe part of June before it gets super hot.
They'll get stressed.
And then it gets hot and they'll get stressed. So.
And they'll need water even though they're drought tolerant. They need water because their root systems are little.
Thanks for reminding people of that, Katrina. Gosh, we had so many people lose their brand new gardens last summer because they thought that because they were planting natives, they didn't have to water them. But when you plant a new plant, it needs water to get settled in and established. So if you do plant drought-tolerant plants, as Katrina said, you got to water them this summer or you'll lose them. So, yeah, if you're going to switch to, you know, some of your yard or all of your yard to a beautiful drought-tolerant palette, go for it this month, but don't wait too much longer.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then lastly, on the opposite end of the spectrum, let's mention grass, lawns, because this is what to do in March, so we do want to talk about that. If you have a cool season lawn, like a fescue, it's still relatively cool, so you want to continue to feed them. They usually look fabulous this time of year, bright green, and you give them a little lawn food, and they will just be super, super attractive. This is, you know, March and April, I think, are two of their most beautiful months if you've got cool season lawns. If you've got warm season lawns, they were probably dormant during, you know, December, January, when we did have some cold weather, and we're probably looking a little brown. Well, what you'll see in March is they're really going to start greening up as we get the longer days and the warmer weather. And so for both of those lawns, both cool season and warm season, March is a good time to feed both of them. And as the days get hotter, not yet so much in March, but as the days get warmer, for those cool season lawns, remember you're going to want to raise the height of your mower so that you're not cutting the lawn as short, because when you have longer grass blades, they shade the soil and keep the moisture in your soil a little longer.
And for those of us who still want to have a little bit of lawn, you know, animals, kids, whatever, it's amazing keeping it longer how much less water you need.
It really is. It makes a big difference. So,
and then when I mow the lawn too, I leave the grass cuttings on there.
Absolutely. That's a good mulch for the lawn. That's the other thing we should mention quickly. We'll talk about it more when Kay and I talk and in our April show. But as you're planting these new plants, be thinking about mulching, because when we get into the hotter days, it's really going to help save water and keep those plants from getting stressed if you add a layer of mulch after you do your new plantings. And we can talk about that more a little bit in a later show later this month. So, Katrina, is there anything else you want to cover for... Oh, I know what we didn't talk about. We didn't talk about fruit trees.
Fruit trees.
How could we forget fruit trees?
Oh, we can't forget fruit trees.
Oh, we've got like 4 minutes left. Let's talk about fruit trees. First of all, planting fruit trees. We did hope that folks planted bare root fruit trees, deciduous fruit trees, in bare root season, which was January, early February. If you didn't, it's still a good time to plant deciduous fruit trees, but you'll probably have to get them in containers. So you're going to be buying them in pots and digging a hole and planting a potted fruit tree, like peaches or plums or whatever. They may actually already be blossoming in the pot because we had that warm spell in February, which is convincing all of our fruit trees that, hey, it's spring, it's time to bloom. And if that happens and you're planting the tree, just be aware that through the transplant shock, you shouldn't be expecting to get a lot of fruit on a brand new planted fruit tree, and you may see those blossoms fall off pretty quickly as they go through the transplant shock.
And but even if we have a brand new tree and it's you don't want to leave the fruit on the first year anyways, because it takes it away from the roots.
Exactly.
Right, Tina?
Exactly. But I do know, I do tell people whose face falls when I tell them that, I say, okay, if you want to leave 3 fruits on your brand new fruit tree so that you feel like you accomplished
something,
you know, leave a couple. But by and large, as Katrina said, you want to knock them all off.
And the reason for that is that you want the energy going into the roots and growing and not into the fruit. So investment now for future gain. Sacrifice those few pieces of fruit this year, and you'll have many more fruit the following few years.
Absolutely. The other fruit that it's now time to plant, which you wouldn't have wanted to plant any earlier than this, March is the first month that you want to plant citrus and avocado. And the reason we don't plant those earlier is they are susceptible to frost damage. So we want to wait until all danger of frost has passed, which is in March-ish. And so now's the time from March, you know, forward in the spring and early summer that you want to go ahead and plant any new citrus or avocado trees that you want to get in the ground.
Fun.
Yeah, and then let's talk about care. in our deciduous fruit trees, I'm not sure how many chill hours we're actually going to get this year. We started out great. We actually got good chill hours in December and January, but then February was so warm, I'm not sure what we're going to end up with for chill hours. And for folks who haven't heard us talk about that before, deciduous fruit trees, each variety needs a certain amount of chill hours in order to set fruit. And where we live, we don't get many chill hours. So when you buy a deciduous fruit tree, you always want to look for a low chill variety. So a low chill apple, a low chill peach, etc. Hopefully we got enough chill hours to get a decent crop this year on our deciduous fruit trees. And what we're going to see this month is we're going to see blossoming. You might have even seen it last month because we did have that heat spell. And the blossoms will be what turn into fruit. So you want to keep your tree, you know, watered regularly. If we don't get any rain, you are going to want to water your fruit trees during this period of blossoming and fruiting so that they will have a nice crop. And you do want to also look for disease. And then later on in the year, we're going to talk in May and June about thinning your fruit so that you don't end up having too much on your tree, because you want your fruit to not be overburdened because you want to get good quality fruit. But we can talk about that more in a future month, because I think we're about out of time.
I think we're good. Boy, did the time go fast today.
And it's going to go fast in March because it's going to be busy.
Yes. Get your soil ready. Take care of your bugs. Insects, excuse me, we don't say bugs anymore. I say bugs to the kids. But take care of your insects. Well, I think we're just about there, Tina.
It's been fun.
It's been fun. I thank you very much, and thank you for sharing your wisdom and your knowledge. And this is Katrina Kirkaby and Tina Spindler signing off. And thank you for being with us in the garden with UC Master Gardeners.